In part two of our deep dive into The Shining, we unravel the second half of Kubrick's haunted masterpiece, and the rabbit hole only gets deeper. We'll decode the Adler typewriter, the phoenix and eagle symbolism, and the transformation of room 217 to room 237. From Faustian bargains to Kabbalistic bathtubs, from Eraserhead to the Grady twins and Roger the Dogman, we're digging into Horace Derwent's Epstein-coded parties, Baphomet bears, red rum, and Kubrick's ritual-laden overlook maze. The veil is thinning. That's right. If you're here listening to part two, that means you've already listened to part one. And if you didn't, I don't know what you're doing here. Go back and listen to part one. It was the episode right before this. Because in part one, we gave a critical look at the cast and crew and the background of The Shining. And then we walked through the first half of the movie. Now today in part two, we're going to finish the movie itself. And then I'm coming back for the next episode for part three, where we're going to decode everything and try to make sense of what the conspiracies are and what the real occult symbolism is behind this film. All right. Now, same deal as the last time, right? You want to watch the video version? Just go sign up for tier two, patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher or the VIP section. Tier two gets you the early access ad-free version of the video. Otherwise, you're on that free feed loser status for the video, which you gotta wait, and then there's pesky ads. Oh my god, what a nightmare. You don't want to do that. And same as last time, explicit language. Trigger warnings, right? For sexual abuse-type discussions. Same thing as last time, as part one. So, with all that out of the way, let's continue where we left off at the end of part one. At the end of part one, we saw Dick Halloran talking to Danny about The Shining, and he gives him a final warning. He says, do not go to room 237, Danny. All right. So in today's analysis in part two, we resume the film. We're told it's now a month later, and Danny is riding his big wheel around the hotel. This is a thing that happens a few times in the movie. And these big wheel clips are what some of the sort of crypto Kubrologists used to map out the actual hotel. A lot of people before me have spent a lot of painstaking time trying to recreate this hotel, and what they found was nothing lines up. There's floors where there shouldn't be floors. There's hallways where there shouldn't be hallways. And the implication is that Kubrick made this a maze. He made it very surreal. It doesn't make sense. So Danny riding the big wheel around the hotel is the way of sort of forcing us to take a look at that, okay? So Wendy, she's sort of doing room service here, and Jackie's sleeping until freaking noon. And you'll notice the usage of the mirror again. And same as last time, I've got images. I'll put them on the Instagram, but also the video version, I'm going to play the images while I speak and play the movie clips and so on, okay? So we have the usage of the mirror again, the portal. And you notice in Kubrick movies, he uses the mirror prominently, featured in Eyes Wide Shut when Alice is looking into the mirror. It's in the movie poster. And Wendy asks if Jack will go on a walk with her. And he's like, no, I got to keep writing this book, even though he's sleeping until noon. And we see the Colorado room where it's where he's doing all his great writing. And Jack has his typewriter set up, and the typewriter is an Adler typewriter. And we're going to talk about that in a sec. But he's aggressively throwing a ball against the wall, still not writing. He's throwing a ball against the wall against Native American artwork. Again, another reference to the Native Americans, this tension between America and Native Americans. And we talked about this in my book, Kubrick's Code. The typewriter that Jack is using in the film is a German Adler. And Adler in German means eagle. Because in Stephen King's novel, Jack is using a typewriter called an Underwood. And this is one of the main arguments for The Shining being actually a film about the Holocaust. Kubrick himself was Jewish. There's arguments that he had maybe some anti-Semitic views at times. But he was married to Christian Harlan, and she was the niece of the German filmmaker Viet Harlan. And Viet Harlan was recruited by the Nazi minister of propaganda himself, Joseph Goebbels. to be the leading director of propaganda. So Kubrick probably had many discussions about this, right? He's a filmmaker himself. He's very knowledgeable in symbolism and propaganda himself. It seems all too perfect. Now, the eagle is interesting in terms of symbolism. If we refer to The Secret Teachings of All Ages, a book by 33-degree Freemason Manly P. Hall, he talks about the zodiac and how it's connected into all this. And because the reason why that's important is because they believe in this idea of ritual magic, hermetic principles, as above, so below, right? It's the idea that the cosmos are, the things happening in the cosmos are linked to the things happening here on Earth. A magician can use his or her will to cause changes in the universe, and so on. I'm going to read you from Secret Teachings. It says, Scorpio being the sign of occult initiation, the flying eagle, the king of birds, represents the highest and most spiritual type of Scorpio, in which it transcends the venomous insects of the earth. As Scorpio and Taurus are opposite each other in the zodiac, their symbolism is often closely intermingled. In ancient calendars and constellations, it says the scorpion, the constellation Scorpio of the zodiac, joins with Mithras in his attack upon the bull, and always the genie of the spring and autumn equinoxes are present in joyous and mournful attitudes. Now, the book goes further into this idea of the symbolism of eagle as the ruler of the mundane, of the masses, the mouth breathers, you and I, okay? Because they have this very elitist worldview that only the elites deserve the best. Kind of like how Stuart Allman says, only the finest people come here, right? They look with disdain upon the middle and lower class, peasants. Aleister Crowley said, the slave shall serve. That's how they view us, okay? Among the Greeks and Romans, the eagle was the appointed bird of Jupiter and consequently signified the swiftly moving forces of the demiurges. Hence, it was looked upon as the mundane lord of the birds, in contradistinction to the phoenix, which was symbolic of the celestial ruler. The eagle typified the sun in its material phase and also the immutable demiurgic law beneath which all mortal creatures must bend. The eagle was also the hermetic symbol of sulfur and signified the mysterious fire of Scorpio, the most profoundly significant sign of the zodiac, and the gate of the great mystery. Being one of the three symbols of the Scorpio, the eagle, like the goat of Mendes, that's go with the bobs, right? That's the Baphomet, which, plot spoiler, at the end of The Shining, that's what Jack is doing, the stance of the Baphomet. He's goating with the bobbins. Being one of the three symbols of Scorpio, the eagle, like the goat of Mendes, a.k.a. the Baphomet, was an emblem of the theurgic art and the secret processes by which the infernal fire of the scorpion was transmuted into spiritual light fire of the gods. Now, the eagle is very important to all of the mystery religions because it is the spirit of the phoenix. It's a symbol that represents the alchemical transformation of mankind. The initiate is reborn into the new understanding of this world and rises from the ashes like a phoenix, right? That's why it's represented as the final stage of alchemy. Kubrick, knowledgeable about the concepts of alchemy, as is evident from 2001 A Space Odyssey. But should my dear listener not believe me yet, let's keep reading. Manly P. Hall. He connects the phoenix to the actual American eagle, because that's where we're going with this, right? We're talking about America oftentimes. All the colors in the film, the red, white, and blue and such. European mysticism was not dead at the time the United States of America was founded. The hand of the mysteries controlled in the establishment of the new government, for the signature of the mysteries may still be seen on the Great Seal of the United States. Careful, which, by the way, was at the Republican National Convention in 2024? Yeah. They had the Great Seal. Do you remember that? With the pyramid with the all-seeing eye? New World Order stuff. Careful analysis of the seal discloses a mass of occult and Masonic symbols, chief among them the so-called American Eagle, a bird which Benjamin Franklin declared unworthy to be chosen as the emblem of a great, powerful, and progressive people. Here again, only the student of symbolism can see through the subterfuge and realize that the American Eagle upon the Great Seal is not, is but a conventionalized phoenix. a fact plainly discernible from an examination of the original seal. In his sketch of the history of the seal of the United States, Galliard Hunt unwittingly brings forward much material to substantiate the belief that the original seal carried the Phoenix bird on its obverse surface and the Great Pyramid of Giza upon its reverse surface. So there you go, America, illuminate, confirm us. The eagle holds great significance in terms of the secret destiny of America, also written by Manly P. Hall. It's about basically this New Atlantis, Neoplatonist fantasy, Plato's Republic, this idea that the scientific elites should, or AI, should be the new governing body, because people are just too dumb left to their own devices. And that's why you see the symbolism of all these occult concepts in the NASA, you know, pagan system, on the patches and so on. And that's the main idea of occult symbolism in the world of conspiracy, is that they're trying to do alchemical transformations of the entire country on some level. So Wendy and Danny, they're running into the labyrinth, and Danny says, loser has to keep America clean. I'll play the clip for you. What are they talking about now?
All right, you're going to lose. And I'm going to get you. You better run fast. Look out. I'm coming in close. All
right. Loser has to keep America clean.
Oh, no.
Keep America clean.
Okay. Danny, you win.
I think the reason they say that is because back in that time, there was a Keep America Beautiful public service announcement released in 1971 with this Native American crying. And to me, it seems kind of like, I don't know, it's drawing attention to Native America, Native Americans, and USA. Okay. Now, what's more interesting is that they're running into a labyrinth, and the labyrinth is not in the book at all, which is kind of crazy. Labyrinth is an idea loaded with symbolism. It's a journey for the initiate. And it's like the original Greek mythology of the labyrinth of the Minotaur, which was all about imprisoning the Minotaur. And Theseus has to conquer this maze to confront the shadow, right? That's always like the individuation process of Carl Jung. Or you could argue, like I will in part three, that Jack Nicholson's character, Jack Torrance, is confronting his own shadow. But in the Minotaur mythology, it's about confronting the shadow that's all the way in the center of the maze. It's deeply seated. You got to work towards it. And it's a bit of a play on what Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons were doing with Crossing the Abyss, or confronting Caron's Own, the shadow. They wanted to destroy the ego fully so they could cross the abyss and become masters of the temple. And the labyrinth is symbolic of the great work, right? This is what all these occultists are always talking about. It's becoming reborn with this occult gnosis. Carl Jung had symbolized the personal unconscious mind as a labyrinth, and a person would need to navigate the labyrinth and go deep into the center to find the shadow, to find their true self. Because, you know, as you grow, you are programmed from social norms and constructs and church and politics and parents and family and friends and all this stuff. It just, your brain is just soaking all this stuff up, and you don't really have a true self in there. It's buried in there, right? Now, it's very interesting. Kubrick would add these elements to the story that, again, wasn't in the book. And it's kind of like how the interior shots of the hotel are not really possible, and it doesn't make any sense. It's like an M.C. Escher artwork with different worlds folding on top of one another, multiple dimensions of reality existing in one space, and it creates a liminal realm, or what they call it today, back rooms. And it's a sort of ports into this world where we're not really sure what's real, what's a hallucination, are they dreaming, are they awake? Why did some of these things not make any sense? This is kind of like the world of Twin Peaks, right? Very David Lynch. And in the book, there's no labyrinth, but there's these hedge animals that come to life. It's pretty creepy. Jack is like he when he's outside working, he senses them looking at him and he senses them moving. It's pretty unnerving. And I haven't seen the TV version of The Shining. I mean, just on principle, it can't be as good as Kubrick, right? But I think that the hedge monsters are possibly in the TV version. I could be wrong. So Kubrick, we get the classic Kubrick crossfade of Jack Torrance and Wendy and Danny running around the labyrinth. And he's kind of just sulking around the hotel, and he throws this tennis ball against the wall, and it basically disappears. You don't really see it go anywhere. Just it makes a noise like it bounces off the wall, but you don't see it. Now that same ball is going to come back later. We're gonna find out where it went mysteriously. And at this point, he leans over this giant diorama on a table of the exact labyrinth that's outside, and it zooms in to the labyrinth on the table inside the house, and it shows Wendy and Danny in the center of the labyrinth running around. What are we even talking about? It doesn't even make sense. This was just like the film Heretic. If you haven't listened to my Heretic analysis, boy, have I got a treat for you. I didn't even realize it. I'd seen The Shining many, many times, and when I did the Heretic film analysis, which has a similar situation where Mr. Reed is using ritual magic in a way, and he's controlling this reality that he can kind of lean over his own diorama and see the characters moving around. He's controlling reality through magic and this diorama, as above, so below. I'll put a link in the show notes. If you haven't listened to the Heretic film analysis, oh boy, that's a good one. It's a real doozy. All right, now we are shown on the screen that it's now Tuesday. You'll notice Kubrick changes it. It'll be like a month later, Tuesday, 4 p.m. It's like, what? None of it. You can't get your bearings, and that's the point. Danny big wheeling again down on a new floor, and this time we've got this carpet pattern the iconic Shining carpet pattern. He stops at room 237, but the door's locked. Again, he's wearing red, white, and blue, as usual. What's Jack Torrance doing? Well, he's finally typing. Oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness he broke his writer's block. And Wendy comes by to check on him. She's also wearing red, white, and blue. And Jack's being a total jerk. He's like, you know, these interruptions are distracting me and slowing me down. So he implements a new rule. If I'm in here typing, or if I'm not typing, or whatever the fuck I'm in this room, it means he's working. So don't come in. Do not bother him. And then he drops the abusive line, why don't you start right now and get the fuck out of here? With the ultra villain, mega Jack Nicholson eyebrow arch. Now you'll see echoes of this in Twin Peaks as well, because Leo Johnson, he also loved to make roles. He was also abusive to his wife, Shelley Johnson. He was big on telling her the rules, like she can only smoke a certain brand of cigarettes, and he showed her how to clean the floor and so on. So we finally get the first dreaded snowstorm, and Wendy and Danny are playing in it, wearing red, white, and blue yet again. And we get the classic meme of Jack Torrance staring off into space like a total maniac. And you'll notice behind him is a fire, like a giant fireplace. And this is very much the same symbolism that Lynch used in Twin Peaks with Ben Horn being an evil character and showing the fireplace. But what's real creepy about this scene is that at the end of it, Jack Torrance, he looks up like he's looking at a spirit or something. What's my man looking at? It's very clear. If you're watching the video version of the show, you can see the clip. Well, now it's Saturday. We skipped some days. Jack's typing, though. Still working. Wendy's in the control room. She's trying to figure out the radio system. She gets it figured out. She calls KDK1, which is the Forest Service, from her radio, which is KDK12. We hear about the storm is the worst they've ever seen, naturally. Fun fact, there's an homage to The Shining and Breaking Bad where there's a police officer who uses the KDK-12 call sign right before he catches an axe to the dome piece. Huh? Good one, Breaking Bad. That was a great show, too. Danny is big wheeling around, and he sees the Grady twins again. And they say, come and play with us, Danny, forever and ever and ever. Super creepy. And then he also has the vision, the shining vision of them butchered with the axe. He's still wearing red, white, and blue, in case you were wondering. He tells his invisible friend Tony, his alter ego, his alter dissociated alter, that he's scared. And Tony says, it's just like pictures in a book. It isn't real. And if you want more on that, in Kubrick's Code, my book, I talked about the photographer Diane Arbus, who Kubrick had studied, and she took photos of, you know, a bunch of freaks. I think you freaky and I like you a lot. So if you want more, check out Kubrick's Code. Monday. Now it's Monday. And it's time for what could be the creepiest scene in the whole film, in a way. Jack, he's bugging out, right? He's losing it. He calls Danny into the room to sit on his lap. And what makes it creepy is how Jack is behaving and how Danny is acting pretty disassociated. He's still wearing red, white, and blue, by the way. Danny asks if he's feeling all right. Jack says he's just tired and he's got too much to do to sleep. And it's kind of a long clip, so my folks with ADD, hang in there. It's going to be a minute. But let's check out this dialogue of these two talking, and I'll come back.
How's it going, Dad?
Okay.
Having a good time?
Yes, Dad.
Good. I want you to have a good time.
I am, Dad. Dad?
Yes?
Do you feel bad?
Tired.
Then why don't you go to sleep?
I can't. I got too much to do.
Dad?
Yeah.
Do you like this hotel?
I love it. Don't you?
I guess so.
Good. I want you to like it here. I wish we could stay here forever.
Dad?
What?
You would never hurt Mommy or me, would you?
What do you mean? Did your mother ever say that to you? That I would hurt you?
No, Dad.
You sure?
Yes, Dad.
I love you, Danny. I love you more than anything else in the whole world. I would never do anything to hurt you. Never. You know that, don't you?
Yes, Dad.
So Danny asks Jax if he likes the hotel, and Jax says, I wish we could stay here forever and ever, just like the Grady twins, right? Danny asks if he would hurt Mommy, because he sees in the future with The Shining, and he thinks he's going to hurt her. Now it's Wednesday, And Danny's playing on that same carpet, the iconic shining carpet. And a ball comes rolling in. And this is what I propose to be the same ball that Jack Torrance throws against the wall that disappears earlier. This hotel's weird. And he stands up. He's playing with these toys. And a ball comes rolling down to where he's playing. And he stands up. And he's wearing a sweater that says Apollo 11. Again, red, white, and blue. And he walks down the carpet towards room 237, which is where the ball came from. I'm going to play the clip, and then we'll come back. Now, this is the scene that's the linchpin in the Jay Widener conspiracy about the fake moon landing. Because as everybody already knows, in the book version of this story, it's room 217. In Kubrick's film, he changes it to room 237. The official supposed version is that the Timberline Hotel, where they filmed the exterior shots for this, had a real room 237, and they were worried that people would be scared to stay there. It's a different world today. There would be a sales pitch, but anyway, they were worried people would be afraid to stay there, so they say, "Hey, can you just change it to?" I'm sorry. Let me back up. The Timberline supposedly had a real room 217. They asked Kubrick to change it to 237, and that's why it's 237. Which begs the question: why does the Timberline have a room 217, but not a room 237. Who knows? Also, I think Jay Widener, I heard him say that if you looked into it, the Timberline doesn't even have a room 217. Nonetheless, Jay Widener's theory is that Danny, wearing the Apollo 11 rocket shirt, stands up from the launch pad. That's the shapes, the hexagonal shapes or Saturnian shapes on the carpet. And he travels down to room 237, which is symbolic of the Apollo 11 launch going 237,000 miles to the moon, which is the distance it was back then. Apparently, it's off a little bit. Now it's a little different. But back then, it was 237,000 miles, and which is also crazy to think of, because if they didn't know the miles to the moon back then, you're telling me we got people to the moon? That doesn't make any sense. But the whole thing with the moon doesn't make sense to me. I strongly believe we never did. We never sent human beings to the moon. I wrote about it in my book, Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture. Check it out. And I did an episode on it, I don't even know, a couple years ago. And then also, the key in the lock at room 237 says room NO237. And Jay Widener says you move those letters around and it says moon room. It actually is moon ROM, technically. And then also the numerology of this is interesting. If you do the numerology stuff, 2 by 3 by 7 equals 42, which is the same number you see on Danny's shirt. 42 shows up a bunch. We'll talk about it in part 3. Also, the Grady twins could represent the Gemini astrology sign, the Gemini twins. The Gemini program was the predecessor to Apollo. And again, the twins are not in the book. So Kubrick threw that in there. So Wendy, she hits some high voltage switches in the basement. She hears Jack yell when she hits these high voltage switches, and she walks as slow as humanly possible towards the Colorado room to check on him. Good news, Jack's just having a violent bad dream, and he's screaming, and she wakes him up, and he's shook, and he's, I had the worst dream ever. I dreamt I killed you and Danny and cut you up into little pieces.
Ugh.
Then Danny walks in right on cue, and his shirt is torn, his neck is bruised. What the heck happened? He went into room 237 like Dick told him not to. And Wendy assumes Jack abused him because he had this past of doing that. And Jack, he's like in a catatonic state. He's bugging out while Wendy's accusing him of abusing Danny. You know, she's mama bear style right now. Jack's getting upset, so he stumbles over to the gold room. And in the book, they actually go back and forth between Jack and Wendy. Jack blames Wendy at one point. But they actually talk it out like adults in the book. Because in the book, again, Jack's not a total monster. He's trying to be a good father, trying to be a good husband. Anyways, when Jack's walking down the hallway to the gold room, you'll notice that there's these mirrors. And every time he passes a mirror, he sort of like punches in the air. Strange timing. It's like his reflection is causing some kind of issue. He's confronting the shadow, basically. And you'll notice the colors, emerald, green, gold, and red. Those are all highly charged Wizard of Oz colors. So Jack goes in this empty, you know, gold room. And he says he'd give his goddamn soul for a glass of beer. And right on cue, a bartender in a red tuxedo appears with a full bar of booze. Stranger yet, Jack knows his name. He says, "Hi, Lloyd." How does he know his name? Is it because he's always been there? He's always been the caretaker? Anyhow, I want you to listen to this full dialogue because Jack confesses his feelings about Wendy and Danny. My man is full of excuses. The whole time, Lloyd is just listening stone-faced because, you know, he reads through all of Jack's bullshit, too. Take a listen.
Goddamn soul. Just a glass of beer. Hi, Lloyd. A little slow tonight, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Torrance. What'll it be?
Now, I'm awfully glad you asked me that, Lloyd. Because I just happen to have 220s and 210s right here in my wallet. I was afraid they were going to be there till next April. So here's what. You slip me a bottle of bourbon, a little glass, and some ice. You can do that, can't you, Lloyd? You're not too busy, are you?
No, sir. I'm not busy at all.
Good man. You set him up and I'll knock him back, Lloyd. One by one. White man's burden, Lloyd, my man. White man's burden. Say, Lloyd, it seems I'm temporarily light. How's my credit in this joint, anyway?
Your credit's fine, Mr. Torrance.
That's swell. I like you, Lloyd. I always liked you. You were always the best of them. Best goddamn bartender from Timbuktu to Portland, Maine. Or Portland, Oregon, for that matter.
Thank you for saying so.
I never laid a hand on him, goddammit. I didn't. I wouldn't touch one hair on his goddamn little head. I love the little son of a bitch. I'd do anything for him. Any fucking thing for him. long as I live, she'll never let me forget what happened. I did hurt him once, okay? It was an accident. Completely unintentional. Could have happened to anybody. And it was 3 goddamn years ago. The little fucker had thrown all my papers all over the floor. All I tried to do was pull them up. The momentary loss of muscular coordination. Few extra foot-pounds of energy per second.
So after Jack sells his soul for a bottle of beer, he ironically orders a bottle of bourbon. Okay. In the book, he's actually ordering martinis. He calls them Martians because his friend Al thinks it's funny to call them Martians. Anyhow, at this point in the dialogue, Jack talks about white man's burden, okay? And this happens in the book also. And I believe what he's actually referencing is the idea... because the idea of white man's burden is this concept that the white man needs to expand, colonize, build empires because the elite whites need to civilize the whole world into their superior way of being. So my thought reading the book was that, oh, okay, I think he says that because it's Jack's way of imperializing the drinks, which is why he says it. It's a play on words. It's colonizing Mars or Martians, right? Which could be kind of weird because that ties into Elon Musk and stuff, right? Or maybe it's a reference to the hotel being built on Native American burial grounds as the white man's duty to dominate other cultures. But in this dialogue, Jack says he's got 220s and 210s. He's worried it'll be there till April because that's when the family leaves, is in April. And Jack, he claims that he's never laid a hand on Danny. He would never do anything. That goddamn bitch will never let him forget what happened because he accidentally hurt him years ago. And right when he gets done doing all this, here comes Wendy with a baseball bat to the gold room. She's freaking out because Danny tells her, hey, there's a strange woman in room 237 that tried to kill me. Which you would think in a way Jack would be like, oh, good. Like, I'm not suspect number one anymore. But anyway, then we cut to Dick Halloran. He's watching the news from Miami because he's worried about Danny and the Overlook. He sees this big storm coming into Colorado, and he has like this severe case of the shining. He kind of locks up. Same time, Danny is seizing up. The fuck? In the book, there's this whole thing about him needing to go down to the Sidewinder town, and Wendy and Jack try to figure out how to get down there because he needs some medical attention. I think it's from getting stung by bees. Anyway. Kubrick made this way creepier, for what it's worth. So now Jack goes to investigate. He goes inside of room 237. You see the purple and green carpets. You see the gold and yellow bathroom, kind of like the gold room. And shit gets crazy. Take a listen.
Thank you.
So Jack goes in there and he sees a sexy woman in the bathtub. And she opens up the curtain for Jack to check her out. Now, the bathtub, of course, a very curious decision here to put in there for Kubrick. It's the Kabbalistic cleansing ritual called the mikvah. And we've talked about this countless times on the show. The passage of the moon goddess. You see a lot of celebrities dying in the bathtub. Whitney Houston and Bobby Christina being the most mysterious of all of them. And when you get into the realm of seeing how the music industry works with Diddy, you start thinking, well, maybe these people are into some weird stuff. Anyway, Jack sees this real hot chick nude, and he gets a big old creepy grin. The woman walked towards him, and turns out she's super into Jack. Jack's hot, right? So they start smooching down, and he looks in the mirror, and it's actually an old decaying woman. So Jack's out of there, right? Jack's all horned up from reading that Playgirl, I guess. Now, fun fact, this scene was actually inspired by David Lynch's Eraserhead. Because as you recall in part one, we talked about how Kubrick screened Eraserhead for the cast and crew of The Shining to say, like, this is the vibe we're going for. Because in Eraserhead, Henry, he has this sort of strange infatuation with his neighbor in room 27. And again, the book doesn't have this scene, right? It has similar scenes, but not the same scene. It has Danny go into the room. He sees a spirit, and that's why his shirt gets ripped in the film. But in the book, Jack goes into the room. He gets the heebie-jeebies. He dips. And again, it's room 217. So it's quite different in the book as well. So Big Dick Holleran, he's like calling up Colorado. The phone lines are down. Okay, he starts tripping down a little bit. Meanwhile, back at the Overlook, Jack, he gets back to his hotel room, completely unfazed, by the way. Let's make sure we get that out of the way. Completely unfazed that he was just trying to make love with a dead woman in the hotel that's completely empty. And he just tells Wendy he didn't see anything at all. And he's very tender with Wendy right now. And you'll notice when you watch this film, listen to the background noises. You hear the wind howling, like there's some real spiritual activity drumming up in the hotel. And Jack thinks maybe Danny hurt himself now, since there's no boogeyman in room 237. And Jack wouldn't do this. But Wendy still wants to get Danny out of there. Jack hates this idea. He tells her that she's fucked his life up so far, and she's not about to fuck up his big book deal. Meanwhile, poor Danny, he's tripping balls, and he sees red rum on the door. He sees blood gushing out the elevator. Things are getting bad. So then Jack, he's strolling the halls again, and there's a party going down in the gold room. You got balloons and music, the works. And he heads in, and it's now decorated with lots of red. Before it had green and gold, now it's red and gold, right? Like red rum. I don't know. Just an idea. And he gets some more bourbon. And he's got cash in his wallet, but hey, no charges from the house. Orders from the house. Literal reference, the house is the Overlook. Because the hotel, the Overlook, is actually like a giant spirit machine of some kind. Jack says he wants to know who's buying his drinks. Lloyd says it's no matter. This is the Faustian bargain. Remember, he said he would sell his soul. Well, you just did, dummy. A waiter spills drinks on Jack and offers to clean it in the bathroom. And this is where things get nefarious. Jack goes in the bathroom with the waiter. The waiter says his name is Delbert Grady. Remember, Charles Grady was the guy that asked his kids. Who's Delbert Grady? We don't know. Delbert Grady's in there, and Jack says, hey, I know you. You're the previous caretaker who asked his family. And Jack tells Grady that he knows what he did. But Grady seems confused, and he's like, I didn't do that. And Grady tells Jack, you are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker. And earlier, he did say that in the scene, he says that Jack is the most important person here. I'm going to play the clip. Another long one. Hang in there. You know, I personally love the Kubrick dialogue scene. Some people get very impatient. I think that's the best part of the Kubrick films. Take a listen.
Awfully nice of you to say. Of course, I intended to change my jacket this evening before the fish and goose soiree.
Very wise, sir. Very wise.
Here, I'll just
hold this for you there.
Oh,
to use it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Now, let's see if we can improve this with a little water, sir.
All right, I'll just set my bourbon and advocat down right there.
Won't keep you a moment, sir.
Fine. What do they call you around here, Jeezy?
Grady, sir. Delbert Grady.
Grady?
Yes, sir.
Delbert Grady.
That's right, sir.
Mr. Grady, haven't I seen you somewhere before?
Why, no, sir. I don't believe so. It's coming off now, sir.
Miss Grady, weren't you once the caretaker here?
Why, no, sir. I don't believe so.
You a married man, are you, Mr. Grady?
Yes, sir. I have a wife and two daughters, sir.
And where are they now?
Oh, they're somewhere around. I'm not quite sure at the moment, sir.
Mr. Grady, you were the caretaker here. I recognize you. I saw your picture in the newspapers. You, chopped your wife and daughter up into little bits. And, then you blew your brains out.
That's strange, sir. I don't have any recollection of that at all.
Mr. Grady, you were the caretaker here.
I'm sorry to differ with you, sir. But you are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker. I should know, sir. I've always been here. Did you know, Mr. Torrance, that your son is attempting to bring an outside party into this situation? Did you know that?
No.
He is, Mr. Torrance.
Who?
A nigger. A nigger cook. Your son has a very great talent. I don't think you are aware how great it is, but he is attempting to use that very talent against your will.
He is a very willful boy.
Indeed he is, Mr. Torrance. A very willful boy. A rather naughty boy, if I may be so bold, sir.
It's his mother. She interferes.
Perhaps they need a good talking to. If you don't mind my saying so. Perhaps a bit more. My girls, sir, they didn't care for the Overlook at first. One of them actually stole a pack of matches and tried to burn it down. But I corrected them, sir. And when my wife tried to prevent me from doing my duty, I corrected her.
So Jack's confused. Grady snitching on Danny, saying he's trying to call for help for this situation. Oh, yeah, then it was a hard R. Drops a hard R in the conversation. And Grady says that Danny has a talent he's using against Jack's will, and that, you know, that pisses Jack off. He's a naughty boy. And Jack says it's because of his mother. Grady says perhaps they need a bit more than just a talking to. He's trying to get him to kill his family. And Grady says that his girls didn't care for the hotel either. They tried to burn it down. And his wife also tried to stop him. So he had to correct all of them. So this Grady did kill his family. Why is he acting all suspicious? So Delbert Grady, who everyone said was named Charles, was the caretaker who axed his family. Now he's telling Jack that Jack is the caretaker. Jack somehow knows Grady. He says, haven't I seen you before? How would he have seen him before? Unless he was always at the hotel somehow. And we're getting this, I mean, it's like spiritual finger cuffs of some kind. Because by the end, we feel like these two are locked into this weird reincarnation type environment. When you see the photo at the end of the film, you'll see it. Or maybe Jack's just getting drunk, you know, and his shadow is coming out and confusing things. Or maybe Delbert Grady is Jack's shadow. Because we know that, and this is in the book, we know that Charles Grady was also an alcoholic, and he got drunk and murdered his family. So Jack heads out on the mission, right? And the first step is to cut off that radio. So, you know, and he doesn't just unplug it. He pops out the relays. And Big Dick Holleron, he's flying out to Colorado. He's like, I got to get out there. Danny's in trouble. He drives a car up the pass through the snow. And this is where you get a shot of the crushed Volkswagen, the crushed red Volkswagen, a diss against Stephen King, apparently. Come on, fellas. I love both of you. What are you doing? We don't have to fight. In the book, in this scene, it just says there's an overturned semi. It doesn't mention any Volkswagen at all. So 100% Kubrick on that. Wendy is in the Colorado room, and she's got a baseball bat. Because she's looking for Jack. She wants the smoke. And she goes over to the typewriter to find his typing that he's been doing for all this time. It just says the same things over and over again. It just says, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Stacks and stacks of pages. He's really lost his mind. Jay Widener also points out that the all in a typewriter looks like A11, Apollo 11. And then right on cue, here comes Jack Nicholson around the corner while she's snooping through his beautiful book that he's typing. And he shuts it all down. You know, that damn Wendy, so nosy. He says, how do you like it? Classic Jack Nicholson scene. Again, another long scene. Just enjoy it. This is peak Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall. Insane scene. We'll come back.
How do you like it? How do you like it? What are you doing down? You have some very definite ideas about what should be done with Danny, and I'd like to know what they are.
I think maybe he should be taken to a doctor.
You think maybe he should be taken to a doctor?
Yes.
When do you think maybe he should be taken to a doctor?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
You believe his health might be at stake?
Yes.
You are concerned about him?
Yes.
And are you concerned about me?
Of course I am.
Of course you are. Have you ever thought about my responsibilities?
Oh, Dick, what are you talking about?
Have you ever had a single moment's thought about my responsibilities? Have you ever thought for a single solitary moment about my responsibilities to my employers? Has it ever occurred to you that I have agreed to look after the Overlook Hotel until May the 1st? Does it matter to you at all that the owners have placed their complete confidence and trust in me and that I have signed a letter of agreement, a contract, in which I have accepted that responsibility? Do you have the slightest idea what a moral and ethical principle is, do you? Has it ever occurred to you what would happen to my future if I were to fail to live up to my responsibilities? Has it ever occurred to you? Has it?
Stay away from me.
Why?
I just want to go back to my room.
Why?
Well, I'm very confused. I need a chance to think things over.
You've had your whole fucking life to think things over. What good's a few minutes more gonna do you now?
Stay with me. Please. Don't hurt me.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
Stay away from me.
Wendy.
Stay away.
Darling, light of my life. I'm not gonna hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in. I'm gonna bash them right the fuck in.
Stay away from me. Don't hurt me.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
Stay away from me. Stay away. Please.
Stop swinging the bat.
Stay away.
Put the bat down, Wendy.
Stop it.
Wendy, give me the bat.
Please.
Give me the bat.
Stop it!
Give me the bat.
Stay away.
Stop swinging the bat.
Please.
Stop!
Give me the bat.
Do it!
Wendy!
Die!
Give me the bat.
Stop it!
Give me the bat.
Ah,
God damn!
So Wendy's like, oh, I just want to talk. Jack says, well, what do you want to talk about? And he closes in on her. Danny hears the whole conversation in his head, and he sees blood, right? Jack being a total abusive jerk-off, harassing her about his responsibilities to his employers. You also notice when he's talking to her, he does the 666 hand. He talks about his contract with the Overlook, because remember, he made the Faustian bargain. He said he'd sell his soul for a beer. Jack tells her that he's going to bash her brains in, does some tongue wagging as she backs up the stairs. She's fending him off with a bat. She's swinging the bat at him. She actually swings the bat at him 42 times. Kind of strange. There's that 42 again. She makes contact on the 42nd swing. And we talked about this in Kubrick's Code. Danny also says Red Rum 42 times before his mother wakes up. That's a scene coming up here soon. And they're also watching Wendy and Danny on the TV were watching a film called Summer of 42. The Nazi Final Solution began in 1942. 42 is the answer to everything in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Then there's also the 42 Negative Confessions of Matt. So, you know, is Kubrick indoctrinated into any of these esoteric ideas? I mean, he was interested in them. I know that much because of that book he bought. So she drags him. She hits him with a bat, drags him to the pantry room, closes him in there. She grabs a big old Michael Myers-sized knife. She locks him in this pantry room where he's got, you know, Kool-Aid and Calumet. Tries to get her to open the door. Tries to manipulate her, saying he's hurt real bad. He needs a doctor. Wendy's too smart for that. She's going to leave him in there. Go take Danny down to the Sidewinder town. Bring a doctor back with her. Jack says, you've got a big surprise coming to you. You're not going anywhere. Because he already disabled the snowcat and the radio. She heads out in the snow to check it out. Sure enough, he cut the distributor cap spark plug wires on the snowcat. Then Kubrick shows us that it's 4 p.m. No idea what day. Anyway, Jack's in the pantry room, and he hears a knocking, and it's Delbert Grady. And Grady's shaming him. He's like, bro, your son and your wife are handling you, right? He starts kind of jazzing him up. And he's like, look, me and the boys, we don't think you got the balls to do any of this. So he's talking mad shit, and he pops the lock. And now Jack's able to get out. Meanwhile, Dick Halloran, still in the snowcat, he's heading up the road. Boom, good. Meanwhile, Wendy decides to get a little shut-eye. Great timing for that, Wendy. And Danny's holding the knife, and he's repeating red rum, red rum, red rum, over and over and over, all creepy Creeperson style. Grabs a lipstick, heads over to the door, draws red rum on the door. Wendy wakes up, looks in the mirror, sees the reflection. Big reveal for everyone. It says, it's murder. So, red rum means murder, because that's what he sees, right? There's murder about to happen. So Jack, he's out now. He grabs the axe, starts axing down the door. Wendy and Danny are locking themselves in the bathroom, trying to escape through the world's tiniest window. Only Danny can get out. So she tells Danny, run, hide, whatever. Jack gets to the bathroom door and doing big speech about little pigs. And he axes a hole in the door big enough to fit his head through. And he says, here's Johnny, right? But then she slices his hand with that big old knife. Now, fun fact, Nicholson improvised that whole here's Johnny bit. So classic, probably the most classic line of the film. They both hear Dick Halloran and the snowcat coming up. So like, who the heck is that? So Danny, he comes back into the house. He hides in the kitchen. Jack is stalking around with his axe. Dick shows up yelling like a fool. So Jack hones in on his location and Jack hits Dick with the axe in the chest. And this is in the same location of where he threw that ball earlier that disappeared. So it's almost like a blood sacrifice for the hotel, I think. in the book version, there's hedge animals that attack Dick on the snowmobile. And it's a part of a, I would criticize, the section of the book, and Stephen King's book just goes on and on about Dick trying to get to the Overlook. It's like, bro, I get it. Way too long. Kubrick was totally right to condense that down. And furthermore, plot spoiler for the book, Dick doesn't even die in the book. In fact, he helps Danny and Wendy escape. So shit starts spiraling, right? And we see, you know, Wendy's walking around and she sees all kinds of crazy stuff. She sees the elites, the man bear getting Hummer for the summer. Hummer for the summer. The classic scene in the bedroom where the guy in the bear costume is on his knees with a dude, an elite in a tuxedo. In the book, Stephen King says that it's a party guy who dresses in a dog costume because he's the gay lover for the wealthy owner of the hotel named Horace Derwent. Horace Derwent was throwing hella depraved parties, which made me think of Eyes Wide Shut, made me think of Epstein, made me think of Diddy, right? And towards the end of the book, you hear more about the dog man. Because in the book, it's a dog, a guy dressed up as a dog. In Kubrick's film, it's a guy dressed up in a bear costume. All right. So in the book, you hear more about the dog man. They call him Roger. I'm going to read you from the book. It says, Derwent upended the bottle of champagne and it fell in a foamy Niagara onto the upturned mask. Roger made frantic slurping sounds and everyone applauded again. Some of the women screamed with laughter. Isn't Harry a card? His partner asked him, pressing close again. Everyone says so. He's AC/DC, you know. That means he goes both ways. For you young people out there. Poor Roger's only DC. He spent a weekend with Harry in Cuba once, months ago. Now he follows Harry everywhere, wagging his little tail behind him, she giggled. The shy scent of lilies drifted up. But of course Harry never goes back for seconds, not on his DC side anyway. And Roger is just wild. Harry told him if he came to the masked ball as a doggy, a cute little doggy, he might reconsider. And Roger is such a silly that he did. And it goes on, Horace Derwent is publicly humiliating Roger for laughs. He's abusing him, and everyone's laughing at him, traumatizing him MKUltra style. So in the movie, we recall we saw Danny with the giant teddy bear at his apartment in Boulder, and he's hiding from Jack. But I think the stuffed teddy bear is a reference to pedo abuse, abuse of children, the elites, their role, like Epstein. I think it's all tied in there, especially given the ending of Eyes Wide Shut. We're going to discuss all this in part three. And also, you go back to Nicholson's friendship with Polanski. Obviously, Polanski assaulted a 13-year-old girl. And Jack Nicholson said this about Polanski. He said, Roman has never been one to let anything limit what he does. He's a genius. That's what he said in response to the critiques about his friendship with Polanski and his raping of a 13-year-old. So Danny's outside, and, well, he escapes the kitchen. He runs into the labyrinth to hide from Jack. Outsmarts him, though. He covers up his tracks, goes backwards through the snow, and now Wendy's getting all these weird visuals. She sees Grady with his head blown up. She sees Dick Halloran butchered. She sees the elevators with the blood flood. There's a scene where she sees a bunch of skeletons everywhere. And in the book, she has all these same visions of these partygoers, but she also hears Glenn Miller band playing, which was interesting because that's referenced. That's also in Twin Peaks when Sarah Palmer wants Leland to hurry up because they're going to miss Glenn Miller Night, season 2, episode 8. If you like Twin Peaks, have I got a deal for you? 55 episodes, the Twin Peaks Grey Lodge on my Patreon, patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher. So Wendy goes outside. She finds Danny. They get into Dick's snowcat and head out. While Jack is still traipsing around the labyrinth looking for Danny, he gets a little sleepies, takes a little break, and whoopsie, ends up frozen. Wakes up dead the next morning. So that's how it ends. Jack basically dies trying to confront his shadow in the labyrinth. All right? His dark side wins. Now he's dead. There's danger in crossing the abyss, Aleister Crowley says. You must destroy the ego fully. So then we get the denouement. And the camera zooms in on photos on the wall. And you see Jack Torrance in the front of this crowd of partygoers. And it says it's July 4th, 1921. What? Now, officially, Kubrick told Michael Cement, back when the film was released, that it suggested there was a reincarnation of Jack, which makes sense, right? Because Grady told him he's been the caretaker before. Jack apparently keeps getting reincarnated and keeps on murdering, I guess, failing to confront his shadow or integrate it. Which means Charles Grady is also reincarnating in the hotel as well. They're both trapped forever in this portal, just like the Red Room in Twin Peaks. Oh, my God. Also, in the book, Jack goes to room 217, and in the bathtub, he sees not a sexy woman, but George Hatfield, the boy that him and Al hit when they were drunk driving. And they describe George Hatfield being dead with silver eyes, just like you see the dead people in the Red Room of Twin Peaks with silver eyes. Now, what's curious about this final shot of the movie is that Jack is standing with one arm pointing up and one pointing down. This is the Baphomet. This is the goat with the bobs. The as above, so below, symbolized by one arm pointing up, one arm pointing down. And this was just like when Jack was standing over the labyrinth looking down on Wendy and Danny. That's a bit more of as above, so below. He is the master magician. Fun fact, this photo was actually real. Obviously not with Jack Nicholson's face on it. And it was only recently revealed that the original photo was from a 1921's Valentine's Day ball in London at the Royal Palace Hotel in Kensington. And Kubrick had it airbrushed to show Jack's face over that of Santos Cassani, a ballroom dance instructor. So there you go. The film is complete. But we're not done yet. We're not done yet because I'm coming back. And I'm hopeful I can get it all done in one part. Hopefully part three will be the last part of this. It might be a long one, but we're going to do an in conclusion. And we're going to discuss about all the things that you found in this movie. You and I, together, as one. We're going to talk about the Stephen King drama. We're going to talk about America. We're going to talk about Eyes Wide Shut, the elites accessing hidden realms, occult symbolism, portals. What else do I got on here? Saturn. Oh, I got some good stuff on Saturn. You're not going to believe it. You got to come. The Saturn stuff is worth the price of admission. Wait till we come back for that. That one's going to blow your mind. MK Ultra. What else do I got in my notes? I got lots of stuff. Jack Shadow. And then the big one, blood sacrifices to the gods, the bloodthirsty gods. I'm going to definitely illuminate, confirm this story. So you do not want to miss it. So stay subscribed to this show because I'm coming back in the next episode. It's going to be part three where we're going to wrap it all up, make sense out of everything you've seen today. And it's going to be a great time, and you're going to love it. Now, if you want to support the show, you got options. If you're on that free feed loser status, give me a 5-star review on whatever app you're using. Thank you. If you're wanting to go ad-free and unlock hundreds of bonus episodes, including a 55-episode deep dive into Twin Peaks, sign up for my supporter feeds. I got three of them. Patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher, VIP section on IlluminatiWatcher.com, or Apple Premium. If you're already on those, if you're on Patreon or VIP section, consider upgrading to Tier 2 if you want the video version of the show. Okay? All right. Thanks for listening to the show. Till next time, stay positive.